It's very easy to have the impression that the primary concern of the Buddha was the teaching and practice of formal meditation. I think it's an impression that doesn't really do justice, I think, to the breadth of the Buddha's teachings. And if you take the time and look a little bit more carefully at the teaching, I think it's probably more true to say that the Buddha's primary concern was the living of an awakened life. In reality, in all of his teaching years, he would ask people to stop a little and to really take an honest look at how they were living their lives. And to take an honest look at the kind of values that were being embodied. As the Buddha recognized, as I'm sure we all recognize, in every moment of our lives, whether we're speaking or silent, whether we're standing or still or moving, we are, in reality, always practicing something. Something is being practiced. And this was actually the heart, I think, of the Buddha's inquiry. For us to look, because we are the only ones who can know, what it is that we are actually practicing moment to moment. What it is that is shaping our thoughts, our speech, our actions, what it is that is shaping how we relate to the people we love and the people we struggle with and the people we feel more indifferent towards, to have a look in our own lives, because again, we are the only ones who can truly know this, to look at our own lives and to look at what it is that leads to distress and alienation and disconnection and struggle, and to look at what it is in our own lives that will lead to the end of distress and alienation and struggle. And for me, one of the great gifts of the Buddha's teaching, I think part of his genius, was to suggest that we can take bewilderment out of our lives. That we can take out of our lives this sense of bemusement, wondering, how did I end up here? A question which is often followed by the word again. How did I end up here again? I think what the Buddha suggested was actually we can understand our world. We can understand the construction of our world moment to moment. That is what the path he taught was truly concerned with, was to understand that we are living in a world, an inner world, that is being shaped and formed moment to moment. And in that shaping and forming of our inner world, our emotional world, our psychological world, we are not helpless. We don't have to live an accidental life. That there is the possibility of living an intentional life. And an intentional life really has its roots in that very question I began with, of knowing what we are practicing moment to moment. Now, 2,600 years ago, the Buddha, as a young man, sat underneath the Bodhi tree and embarked upon what he later came to call a noble quest, or a noble search. I think it's very important to be careful not to too much idealize or to romanticize the Buddhist search, because it was certainly not a search that was unique to Siddhartha. Instead, if we look around the world, what we see are the countless women and men of the past, of the present, who have embarked or who are embarking upon a very similar search. And it may well be that you are too part of that community. We see people in cloisters on mountainsides. We see people in the midst of families, in the midst of communities, undertaking a quest to understand what it means to live what we might call an authentic life. A life that is guided by inner authority, a life that is guided by wisdom, that embodies compassion, that embodies dignity and integrity, doing what we're doing exactly right now, learning what it means to be still and to listen inwardly and to ask the questions that are important in our lives. As a young woman, 14th century India, she said, "To learn the scriptures is easy, to live them hard. The search for the real is no simple matter. Deep in my looking, the last words vanished, joyous and silent, the waking that met me there is." This is a long historical quest. Now, the Buddha's search, I think, like all noble searches, really began with insight. That Siddhartha saw in his own experience that the ultimate security and peace and freedom was not going to be found in the world of conditions. And that a life governed by aversion or governed by fear and resistance was not a life of dignity and was not a life of freedom. And prior to his own awakening, Siddhartha described his own mind as being often filled with disquiet, as being unreliable, where too many thoughts and emotions seem to act as gatekeepers of his happiness and freedom. And he saw for himself how often he just felt to be swept along in his life upon waves of habit and impulse. Sound familiar at all? And he saw for himself that as long as he lived locked within a belief in insufficiency and lack, he was going to be equally locked within a world of agitation and a diminished sense of possibility. It was these core insights that actually brought Siddhartha to the Bodhi tree. And I think for many of us, actually we hear these insights and we hear the echoes of them in our own experience. And it is often these same insights that bring us to a cushion. Now, when the Buddha described this path of the noble search, he described it as seeking for an unborn, supreme security, freedom from bondage, the search of a freedom from sorrow and struggle, a sublime peace. Now, I think that many people, when they hear the word noble or a noble search, there can sometimes be a little bit of an inner struggle in applying it to themselves and to their own experience and their own path, when we find ourselves kind of slumped within our sweat suits and looking forward to the end of the evening and going to bed, or lost in a fantasy, or just struggling to find a breath or two. The word noble is may not be the first word that appears to describe what is going on. It sounds too dramatic. It can sound too kind of overstated. Yet by all accounts, Siddhartha did not sit under the Bodhi tree with a mind filled with sublime thoughts and boundless friendliness and boundless compassion. No. As the Buddha himself described it, he sat under the Bodhi tree, actually grappling with aversion and doubt and craving and resistance. But he did learn to sit with them. And he did learn to look them in the eye and come to know that this was not the place he wished to make his home. Not the place he wished to make his home, and he refused to participate in their dance. I think this word noble, like most words that come from Pali, is far better translated into a verb form of ennobling. This word ennobling is a much used word in this tradition, this teaching, this path. And rather than feeling somehow dissociated or disconnected from this word or unworthy of it, I think it can help us to reframe our own journey and help us to reframe our own practice. What is it that brings us here? Do we not, you know, when we go beneath many of our narratives and many of our actions, in this life, do we not find ourselves longing to know what it means to live a life of dignity and poise and equanimity? Do we not long to know what it means to have our words and our acts spring from love and compassion? Most of us probably truly long to know a life which is not governed by fear and to find in ourselves the roots and the source of an unshakable peace and freedom. To know how to live in harmony with others. This is a great longing. It is a noble longing. To know within ourselves, to long to find the way to be in this world that has so much pain and so much struggle and so much sorrow, to know how to be with this, with wise action and with grace. Awakening, as the Buddha very succinctly described it, it was not a kind of entry into some mystical, transcendent world. But the Buddha put it, he said, as I am, so are you. As you are, so am I. And he encouraged very much to bring often these kind of unverbalized, unarticulated longings really into the forefront of our consciousness and to the forefront of our lives, of how we act and live. When the Buddha described awakening, he talked about it as really simply seeing things the way they actually are. That simple. Born of conditions, changing, and empty of self. And he said that in that knowing, he came to know the end of struggle and anguish, and awaken to an inner sense of freedom and sufficiency. And in that awakening, saw the coming to an end of all sense of lack. Now this perhaps sounds familiar. It's a pretty radical change of heart. It is actually a pretty radical change of consciousness to imagine a way of being and a way of seeing in which all sense of inner insufficiency and lack has come to an end. He described this awakening, as many of you are familiar with, in the context of the Four Ennobling Truths. That there is struggle, sorrow, there is a cause, there is an end, and there is a path. And the path is to radically change the nature of our hearts and the nature of our lives. And this is what the Buddha called a noble life. A noble life. That suffering is to be understood, its causes to be investigated, its end to be realized, and its path to be cultivated. So this evening, to actually get to the point of this talk, I usually have a little warm-up here. This evening, I primarily want to look at the causes of suffering. And I want to look at the paradox of this word, desire. And to look at the ways in which one aspect of desire, which is craving, is actually a servant of the belief in insufficiency. And to look at the ways in which craving, rather than calming or bringing a sense of insufficiency to an end, instead only strengthens it. Now, desire is part of our lives. Without desire, we don't get up in the morning. Without desire, we don't get here. Without desire, you don't raise a child. You know, without desire, you certainly, you know, don't get to work or cherish or value anything at all. Desire permeates our lives. I mean, think of it, from the moment that you wake up in the morning and your eyes open and your mind starts to move, how many moments in a day do you find that are actually not touched in some way by desire? Now, I think often the word desire is heard in Buddhist teaching, it's often heard as a kind of blanket condemnation. You know, that if you're a really good Buddhist, you don't desire anything. I think it's often heard as a kind of condemnation of any form of longing, but I think it's a misunderstanding. So what I'd like to do this evening is a little bit to unpack this word desire and to look at the different dimensions of desire that appear in our lives, both the wholesome and the unwholesome, the skillful and the unskillful. I would like to look at some, first of all, at the desires that can be answered. The desires that can be answered. First of all, there's a level of desire which the Buddha very much recognized, which is just the desires that are needed to navigate our way through this life. If you see a car hurtling towards you, it's quite a good idea to have the desire to get out of the way. There's a desire to be not hurt. The body sends out messages of hunger, of thirst that we respond to. If you go out and it's raining, you know, it's not an unwholesome desire to put up your umbrella or take shelter. The desire to protect the well-being of our bodies, to rescue a child from jumping off a cliff. These are the desires that arise and pass. They're kind of the fabric of life, the fabric of having to respond to the world of conditions skillfully. But you'll notice in this level of desire, they don't leave any residues, do they? But don't leave any residues in the mind. After you've put up your umbrella in the rain, you don't spend the next hour beating yourself up about it. You know, that if I was a really good Buddhist, you know, I wouldn't have put up my umbrella, you know, and, you know, maybe I shouldn't have eaten today, you know, when I was hungry. I mean, there is no residues. These are the desires that can be answered. In many ways, they are ethically neutral desires. They are simply the desires that are necessary to live a life and respond to a world of conditions. They can be answered. There's another realm of desire, which in Pali is called chanda. It is the wholesome, or kusala. Kusala is the word in Pali for wholesome. Longings that are translated into action. And this is also a level of desire that can be answered. These wholesome desires, these chanda, kusala desires, are the longings that bring us here. They're the longings that spark our journeys, the longings to know a greater, the desires to know a greater kindness, spaciousness, compassion, the desire to be free from pain. The desire to be free from pain. These are the desires that are part of every social, cultural, political change that are wholesome. They're the every kind of revolution in our culture, every major shift in thinking, every major shift in seeing towards that which is more wholesome has happened because of desire. Whether it is the ending of apartheid, whether it's the ending of slavery, whether it's the end of abuse, all of these shifts have happened because of desire. They are the desires that ennoble our lives, that bring honor and respect. They give shape and direction, actually, to our life and to our path. Without these desires, what does our life look like? Pushed along by the winds of conditions, reactive to momentary experience, but without necessarily a sense of direction, and sometimes a sense of meaning. Now, we can see how these longings are easily drawn, how these desires, which are so wholesome, can be easily so drowned out by our daily preoccupations and busyness that create a kind of amnesia. So there is a value, and the Buddha recommended this so strongly, reflect upon the desires that lead to the end of desire. Reflect upon the desires which it is wholesome and important and essential to value and to keep at the forefront of our consciousness so that we are not so prone to become forgetful and not so prone to become lost in the kind of habitual reactiveness. These are the desires that help us to stop and ask what it is that we are dedicated to. What do we most deeply value? I think without that kind of reflection and without these desires being not only in the forefront of our consciousness but also translated into intention and embody, we all know how easy it is to become so lost in forgetfulness, swept along in our day, on the tide of doing and helping and obsessing and arranging the world as much as possible to protect ourselves from what we dislike and fear. Lost in habits. And then for most of us, every now and again, something comes along in our lives that tells us, reminds us, that the only certainty in this life is that we will die. It is the only certainty. And it reminds us to value the manner of our living above all else. Now, our longings, these kusala desires, are really here to remind us of what is possible for us. In a way, it is almost the promise of this teaching and the promise of this path that the seeds of really profound compassion, the seeds of profound wakefulness and friendliness and integrity lie within each of our hearts. But they are seeds that only grow if they are cultivated and tended to. These kind of kusala desires are not just about having good intentions. They're about what we translate into our lives, what we translate into our actions, our path, because these are the desires that ennoble our lives. They're the desires that lead to the end of desire, and again, they are the desires that can be answered. There's a wonderful verse in the Dhammapada that says that all that we are now is a result of all that we were, and that all that we will be tomorrow or even in the next moment will be the result of all that we are now. It's kind of a wake-up call, isn't it? I'm sure we can all see that how we are now is a result of all that we were. We see the winds of our past experience kind of flooding our consciousness. All that we have experienced, our families, our conditioning, everything that has come into our lives that has so led to shaping who we are in this moment in our life. But what the Buddha emphasized is that every moment in our life is a potential turning point, inviting us to look about where we are making our home in this moment. And it's a question to ask ourselves right now. Where are we making our home in this moment? In busyness or in calm? In anxiety or in simplicity? In aversion or in kindness? When the Buddha spoke about the kind of fruition of this path, he didn't talk about the fruition of this path lying in some impossible, unattainable breakthrough moment, but he spoke about something much more immediate, about tending to where we are and how we are right now, to recognizing the potential turning point in that moment and to look at where we're making our home. He actually spoke about liberating the moment, about learning to liberate the moment. I do quite a bit of retreat teaching, and I have done actually quite a bit of retreat teaching over the years. But I find myself continually, personally awed and almost in a state of wonder at the pretty dramatic and profound changes that people can go through in a few days of a retreat. I find it quite astonishing at times. And it's not because of the geographical location. You know, it's not because retreat centers hold some sort of magical potion, you know, that wreaks transformation. It has nothing to do with that. It is because people choose for a very short period of time to dedicate themselves to living an intentional life. They dedicate themselves to making their home in simplicity, in calming, in gathering, in investigating, in kindness. And it is phenomenal at what an impact that can have. From contractedness to spaciousness, from agitation to ease. And a lot of it has to do with remembering. With remembering. remembering what is important, remembering what is important to be dedicated to. I love that part of a poem by Naomi Shihab Nye, and it's just the last few lines when she says, when someone invites you to a party, remember what parties are like before answering. Walk around feeling like a leaf. Know you could tumble any second. Then decide what to do with your time. Or almost decide what to do with your attention. I mean, think back today. How many parties have you been invited to? And I'm not just talking about, you know, the external events. You know, there's the fantasy party, isn't there? You know, there's the pre-obsession party. You know, the aversion party might have come along, you know, or the preoccupation party, or the rehearsal party, or the anxiety party. Think about how many parties you've been invited to today. And how easy it is to forget what those parties are like before we answer. Then we learn to walk around like a leaf, knowing we could tumble any second. Then sometimes we decide not to do with what to do with our time, but what to do with our attention. What to do with our attention. Another dimension of desire in Pali is described as samvega. Samvega. Sometimes translated as spiritual urgency. Spiritual urgency. This is actually not a stranger to any of us. It has much to do with the fabric of compassion. Those moments when you come across it, you know, a distressed child, the sight of a person caught in some terrible conflict or violence, the sight of an elderly person, perhaps very frail, just struggling to get through their life. And it's about wake-up calls. It's about wake-up calls. It's about the moments when our hearts are disturbed and tremble. And we see in those moments when our hearts are disturbed and tremble how unhesitating our response can be and our presence can be, how wholehearted we can be. When a friend in distress calls us and we find ourselves reaching out in an unhesitating way, simply because of the empathy, the wake-up, the waking up of our heart, touched by suffering, touched at times by the causes of suffering, and the reaching out to heal. Now, this sense of spiritual urgency, I don't think it's anything to do with haste or intensity. I think it has a lot to do with a wakeful heart, about sincerity and compassion, knowing how easy it is to be forgetful and to think that tomorrow is a better day to be awake in. Samvega is a lot about commitment. The Buddha describes that when he sat under the Bodhi tree, he said that he was determined to sit and to be there until his blood ran cold, if that was what was required for his awakening. Sounds pretty dramatic. Sounds pretty dramatic. But I think how we think about how easy it is to engage in postponement practice, you know, waiting for the right conditions in our life to come along for us to be really compassionate and wakeful in. Samvega is a wholesome desire, something to cultivate. So I've talked about the good news around desire, and I'd like to talk about the element of desire which is actually not helpful, and one I think we can probably all identify with. Because this is the realm of desire. It has no end, and it has no answer. That's really good to recognize at this point. It has no end and it has no answer. And of course the word in Pali is tanha, or unquenchable thirst, that rather than ending suffering, brings more suffering. And there's a great curiosity, I think, when we look in our own lives. The Buddha very clearly described craving as being one of the primary causes of suffering, which I think we can see in our own lives. But how much we use craving to try and end suffering. That's a very difficult one at times to acknowledge. That we use the cause of suffering as being the possible means to bring suffering to an end. I'll give you a simple example. You know, I'm very discontented and disquieted. I'm not happy with it. It's painful. I think I'll go to the fridge. I want to go into this much more. Tanha is something to be investigated. When we actually look at the roots of tanha or craving, we see underneath it the belief in insufficiency. I don't have enough. I am not enough. I'm not good enough. We see the belief in insufficiency. And what craving does is to dig the pit of that belief of insufficiency a little bit deeper each time it's pursued. And this is the realm of desire, I think, if we value awakening, it's the realm of desire we're asked to question. Because this is the realm of desire that binds us to suffering. It's a wonderful poem by Rumi. He says, "Who makes these changes? I shoot an arrow right, it lands left. I ride after a deer and find myself chased by a hog. I plot to get what I want and end up in prison. I dig pits to trap others and fall in myself. I should be suspicious of what I want." I think if we truly want to bring suffering to an end, not just emotional and psychological suffering, but indeed the very suffering that permeates our world, craving truly does need to be understood and to be released, and something to be just simply gently honest about. This is not something to be judgmental about or harsh about, but to understand, you know, how core this is in the human condition. And how core this is in the condition of confusion. Not to take it too personally is a good idea. But to truly have that willingness just to understand it. To change the shape of our hearts and minds. To change the shape of our lives. This was always the invitation of the Buddha, to move from insufficiency to sufficiency. To move from a sense of lack to a sense of completeness. But to do that, I think we need to be really honest and to know and to feel the landscape of craving and to feel its agitation. Have you ever felt calm craving? It's that sense of agitation, the sense of momentum, of need within it, abandoning our heart's capacity for contentment. If we can feel the landscape of it, the painfulness of craving, then I think that is where the motivation to really bring craving to an end comes from. Not from some philosophical discussion about craving, oh yes, it's a really bad idea, you know, and I'll think about it later. I think we actually need to feel the thread of it in our lives and what it actually does to our psychology and our emotional well-being moment to moment. There's a very close feedback loop in craving, as far as I can see in my own experience. If we believe and feel a sense of lack and insufficiency inwardly, what do? We go and search the world for things, people, experiences that's going to answer that sense of lack. And we do have momentary successes. It's not that we always fail, but they are only momentary. And then we end up once more aware of this kind of growing disquiet, a growing hunger. And then here we go again in search for an answer. It's a kind of more policy. You know, it's a psychological more policy. More sense impressions, more food, more excitement, more experience, more intensity, more drama. Does it actually make us feel more complete? The more policy? I always think about it. I came across this wonderful thing. I think it's an American tradition of s'mores. But kind of, I mean, it's the whole, everybody knows what a s'more is. Okay. But the whole idea of a s'more is you can never have enough, right? I mean, that's the whole philosophy of it, you know. It's actually supposed to stimulate this desire that you need more. That's the policy. But it's kind of a big policy, isn't it? The more s'more policy. It kind of goes through everything in our life. So I want to look at just some of these cravings that keep us agitated. The first one is obvious, the craving for sensual pleasure. We just want to feel good. There's nothing wrong with wanting to feel good. But that wanting to feel good, which is a very human, obviously, a very human longing. We don't want to feel in pain. We don't want to feel bad. But that very human longing, which we can recognize and respect, but we can also know we are not in this life always going to feel good. But instead, that longing to feel good, of course, gets hijacked by the ideology of craving. So we're looking for more sense pleasure, more pleasant sounds, more pleasant sensations, more pleasant touch, more pleasant through the eyes, the ears. It becomes a hunger. You can even feel the sense of me is an appetite. I mean, you can feel how the sense of me is actually built around craving. It's actually built around craving. Prowling the world, believing that we can only be happy in the midst of pleasant experience. That we can only be safe in the midst of pleasant experience. That the source of joy and the source of happiness always lies elsewhere. What the Buddha discovered, and I think what countless practitioners through time have discovered, that when we can find the willingness to step out of the fires and the agitation of pursuing cravings, when we can learn to be a little bit more calm, a little bit more still in our minds and bodies, what we can begin to discover is an inwardly generated joy and happiness. It is actually why so much emphasis is given to formal practice in this tradition. Because it is actually when we can begin to calm, when we can begin to collect, that we can begin to taste an inwardly generated happiness and joy. Not dependent on conditions. Not dependent on getting, not dependent on getting rid of anything. And it is a beginning of a taste of sufficiency. There is much in the world that is delightful, that is lovely. But what we're really discovering and nurturing in this practice is actually our capacity to be delighted. Our capacity to be touched, our capacity to find a sense of joy within and gladness within our own hearts. So this craving for sensual pleasure is the first dimension. The second one, as many of you will be familiar with, is the craving to become bhava tanha, the craving to become someone. I can hardly think of more heavy-weighted craving than this one in our culture. Generally, we call it self-improvement. This is not the same as the kind of wholesome longings for peace, for kindness, for freedom. It is a craving to solidify a sense of self. It's a craving to become lovable, to become acceptable, to become perfect, worthy, resting upon the same sense of insufficiency, that we are not enough. Not good enough, not worthy enough, not lovable enough. And so we pursue. We pursue identities, we pursue roles at times, we pursue states and experiences that tell us we are worthy. Often, though, simultaneously engaged in an ongoing abandonment of our capacity for acceptance and compassion and the sufficiency of our own hearts. How do we know this? I mean, look at this craving to become in our culture. I mean, you know, we start asking children, don't we, when they're about 2 years old, what are you going to be when you grow up? You know, what do you want to become? This poor child's hardly learned to breathe. And already they're feeling this weight, you know, the need to become. The need to become someone, something. How do we see it going on in our own lives? Look at our relationship to praise and blame. If we're very much tied up in tanha, bhava tanha, the need to become, we're not going to do well with blame. It's going to, you know, go directly to the kind of inner insufficiency demon. Oh yeah, of course, you know, I deserve that blame, you know, or we're going to fear it. Notice our relationship to praise. You know, I can feel me, you know? But it's all wrapped around this relying upon being someone in order again to feel that sense of safety and protection. I can think of hardly any other impulse than the craving to become that has been so detrimental in our own psychological and emotional freedom. Because what it does, it makes us beggars for approval, where we live for perfection, where we live in fear of failure, of rejection, where we find ourselves at the mercy of the inner critic and the judge. It is all tied up with bhava tanha, telling us something true about ourselves. What do we do in the practice with this? What do we do in the practice with this? We become sensitive to and question the story of self-making. The story of self-making. The narrative we tell ourselves, really, that the story of insufficiency is a story that is being told in different forms many times in our lives, but it's building the story of I. But I'm not really telling the story of insufficiency. Instead, the story of insufficiency is telling me who I am. I think that's so important to see. Listen to the stories. You hear the thoughts arising. You know, I'm really a bit of a blue and I'm a failure. You know, I should have done that better. I really didn't do that very well. And can you not see how that, can you feel how that story you tell yourself is actually building the story of me in that moment? It's building the story of the insufficient self. We learn, actually, so there's such a relief in this practice. In learning to know a story as a story. I mean, it sounds so simple, doesn't it? You know, but there is such a relief in being able to know a story as a story rather than a self-building construction. What we actually see, I think, as we look more closely, that selfing and craving and clinging, agitation, they're all threads of the same cloth. And if we unravel one thread, we unravel the whole of the cloth. The third of the cravings is the craving for non-existence. It's the craving that robs our lives of nobility. It's a big one. We find it on very moderate levels at times, this craving for non-existence, the little flickers of aversion and resistance. We just want something to go away. We just want something to disappear. You know, it doesn't feel very dramatic, you know, but it could be a pretty ongoing flicker in our life, you know. How do I just make this go away? You know, this feeling in my knee, you know, that sound of the air conditioner, the rain, you know. I just want it to go away. Sometimes it's very moderate, sometimes it's pretty big. It's pretty big. It's the ill will, it's the hatred, it's the fear, it's the anxiety, it's the desire to push our life away, to divorce ourselves, to disconnect from what is, sometimes even to annihilate ourselves. This craving for non-becoming, sometimes it's the ways that we make ourselves invisible. Sometimes we find it through numbness, through not feeling, not experiencing. It is a craving difficult to approach, but we are asked to approach it. To nurture in our hearts the courage to face the winds of the difficult. To nurture our capacity for acceptance and for care. And the capacity to be with. The capacity to be with. Can you imagine if we read the story of Siddhartha? He sat under the Bodhi tree, seemed like a good idea. That's too hot. Mosquitoes are bad. Didn't bring a picnic. No, I don't like that thought. I'm going to disappear. It would be a very different story, wouldn't it? It sounds sometimes innocuous, the craving for non-becoming, but it can be so, it can govern the whole of our lives. Trying to build a world where there is no difficult, and yet at the same time abandoning our capacity for fearlessness, and for courage, and for equanimity, and for uprightness. If we understand the causes of suffering, release ourselves from the grip of craving, we will come to know the end of suffering. When the Buddha described the landscape of liberation, he described it as the complete freedom of heart and mind from the compulsion of craving. And he called this freedom the taste of the Dharma, an ennobling life. Craving is not something to be judged, but to be understood, to be embraced with mindfulness, to know that it's a reflexive action or a reflexive reaction to a belief in insufficiency, and know that we can actually learn to be still in those waves. And every moment we can learn to be still in the waves of craving, we actually taste something else. We taste the freedom of being ungoverned. We taste actually the freedom of dignity, of an ennobled life. It's like the little cravings and the big cravings, the little drives and the big drives, the little compulsions and the big compulsions. It's kind of like they're all the arms and legs of one body, the body of lack. But the small and the great moments of stillness and calmness, the small and the great moments of uprightness and spaciousness, of kindness and compassion, these two are all the arms and legs of one body, the body of sufficiency. And that, I think, is the body we come to know inwardly that does ennoble our lives, that does bring that taste of freedom.
Thank you.
To take a moment to stretch, and then we've got a little time for if you have any questions. Okay, does anybody have anything you'd like to reflect upon or any questions about? Yeah. So the question is if it's possible that the craving for liberation can have some overlap with the craving for non-being. It can do if it's unexamined. I think, you know, if you kind of look at the kind of spiritual culture that existed at the time of the Buddha, was very much a culture of transcendence, you know, where the world and everything in it, relationships, people, you know, everything, the body, the mind, where everything was basically really almost deemed as being a kind of obstacle to freedom. And so the kind of way of thinking of the time was, you know, to get out, basically. To get out and to transcend and to get away from this that was deemed as being an obstacle. Now, this was not a kind of view or an ideology that was very particular or specific to the culture in India at that time. I mean, you see it very prevalent in our own culture. You know, where, you know, the regarding of life as a problem, the regarding of the body as something to be abandoned, stimulates a very similar desire to get out. Now, sometimes that it is aversion and it is fear and it is abandonment. It can sometimes become couched in a kind of spiritual language. But if it is disguised aversion, the manifestations will become quite obvious. Lack of care, lack of respect, lack of compassion, lack of kindness, lack of integrity, perhaps the infliction of harm upon the body or the mind or upon others. And it's a disguised aversion. I mean, it's very important to recognize that I don't know of one single Dharma concept that doesn't have a near enemy. You know, and for us to actually discern whether we're entertaining the near enemy or entertaining something quite wholesome can only be an inner investigation. But also to recognize that many times in our lives, our intentions are mixed. It's very human, and I'm sure it's true of all of us. You know, I would really like to be liberated. I don't like my life that much either. You know, but you know, so it's kind of like mixed up together. You know, part of it is wholesome, and part of it's not so wholesome. If we waited in our lives to engage upon or embark upon any path for absolutely pure, undiluted intentions, we would wait for a very, very long time. Okay? So I think it's okay to recognize that at times there is this mixture of the wholesome and the unwholesome. You know, I really want to practice because I really want to discover, you know, inner joy and happiness, then it looks pretty good too, you know. So, I mean, you actually recognize, you know, that there's this mixture of the wholesome and the unwholesome, and that's fine. You know, that there's no reason then that we're going to wait for some perfectly, unalloyed motivation to come marching in. If we recognize it, then actually embarking upon the path, or embarking upon the action, with that kind of inner vigilance, if the action or the path is in itself wholesome and skillful, that in itself will actually be the means to relinquish the unwholesome and the unskillful.
What you were saying a moment ago about throughout the talk about the desire leads me back to some of the things that you were commenting on in the introduction and about embodiment and the necessity of living in the body, living in this.
Yes.
And the practice of embodiment seems to be one that is counter to the desire for non-existence. But I don't hear a lot in some of the teachings that I've experienced about embodiment. And I find myself really puzzled. What is that?
What is embodiment? I think embodiment is a journey. I think it's a practice. For me, embodiment is where there is a dovetailing together of our aspirations and our intentions and the translation of them into our speech and our way of being and our way of caring and our way of acting and the choices we make in our lives. To me, embodiment is this, it is actually that translation of those aspirations and longings and wholesome desires into actually how our life is being shaped. That for most of us is a journey. You know, we see how many times that there is a kind of more, there can be a disconnect. We would really love, for example, to live with kindness until somebody annoys us. You know, we would love to be patient until, you know, or we honor patience and then something goes wrong and, you know, we feel that disconnect between what we most deeply value and then what is actually being manifested or embodied in our life. And it goes back, as you say, to what I was talking about in the beginning, that we are always practicing something. But I think that movement towards that marriage, that dovetailing of aspiration and its realization is actually a journey. And I think in traditional Buddhist teaching or Buddhist teaching, you know, it is the two words that I used of path and fruition. You know, and fruition is actually the maturing of a path. You know, it's not there right in the beginning. But the very direction of a path is to move towards fruition. And embodiment is part of that. That's what I feel about is embodiment. That, you know, it's about healing the gaps. It's about healing the disconnects. But that whole journey of healing the disconnects and healing the gaps, it has to be an ongoing journey of investigation and kindness and not this journey of, you know, of aversion. And judgment, which mostly brings all journeys to an end. So for me, that's what embodiment is about.
Well, it seems like it would bring one then to a full experience of
fruition. Absolutely.
This is the vehicle of that experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Because sufficiency, I think, certainly in kind of Buddhist psychology, I mean, it's uprooting the roots of craving. I don't know how to listen.
I don't know how to listen. Tonight, I'm going all over the place. Like, oh, crazy, you know, one time problems. But, I just started getting into so many stories. And I know, I let them go. I give them credit. But I know, the simplicity is so complicated to me.
I think you're right. I think again there's a paradox here that the simplicity is actually, when you start to unpack it, is remarkably profound. And there's two things I would say. I mean, I think our capacity to listen has a lot to do with how well trained our capacity for wise attention is. You know, that's part of it. I mean, some of those journeys off are not bad journeys, because I think what's going on there is hopefully the place where you're taking what you hear and then applying it to your own experience and trying to figure out what that looks like. So some of those journeys off are actually our kind of own moments and movements into the investigation, which is critical for understanding where something moves from being, abstract into something very real and applied. But what we also see that our capacity for investigation needs to be so wedded to actually a well-trained capacity for attention and mindfulness, so that investigation doesn't turn into sort of, thought rambling. But I don't think you should be too frustrated with that. I mean, I think it's recognizing, yes, there's that genuine effort to try and apply something within the context of your experience to make sense of it. Sometimes that's supported by enough mindfulness and wise attention. Sometimes it might not be. And then it turns more into a kind of a bit more of a speculative, maybe, could be. And you have to learn to recognize those times, I think. When the investigation, it does turn more into a sort of feeling like a kind of amorphous, kind of unfocused mind, And then that's the time, actually, to put it down and to get much simpler and actually just, I don't need to go there right now. Sometimes we're trying too hard to have it make sense, and that's often when it's going off into more kind of narrative stuff. I think it's just helpful to recognize that the flavor of that narrative stuff, when it's not investigation actually anymore, and it's turned into a kind of speculation, or building, it's time just to put it down. I mean, I think, in our culture, curiously, many of us spend a lot of our lives thinking, of course. We give a lot of value to thinking, and, it's kind of very primary in all of our educational situations. We're not always so well trained in how to reflect and investigate. And I think reflection and investigation, it's not so much about figuring things out. I think reflection and investigation really rests upon our capacity to cultivate and to generate sufficient inner stillness and inner listening that we can ask the questions and have the trust and the patience to wait for the answers to arise from that stillness and listening. And I think really this may, you know, something of a difference between the kind of thinking that we're sometimes used to engaging in and the kind of reflection investigation which I think is really emphasized in this path, which really has that ground of stillness and listening. But we're training it. It's a very difficult one, I think, in our culture, because, I mean, certainly I don't think there's any kind of, you know, recipe or encouragement in this path, you know, to sort of imagine a life just glued to a cushion, you know, that, you know, people do have careers and they're often really rooted in very heartfelt, you know, genuine creativity, aspirations, dedications. It's all very important. We live in a world and hopefully we can contribute to it in a meaningful way. It can, I think, culturally get very tied up in success and failure, in self-image and identity, where, you know, my whole sense of being is relying upon the kind of feedback that I'm getting. I think that's where we need to be really quite careful. Can we actually, you know, engage in a life of dedication, in wanting to make a difference, in doing that well? You know, also in doing it, the wish to do things well without it having really this shadow rub against, you know, the inner critic, the desire to be someone in order to feel safe and protected, in order to get the approval. That's all the business of insufficiency. You know, the need for approval, the fear of blame, you know, because that's where we just lay ourselves at the mercy of that belief in insufficiency. How we look at that rub between that genuine engagement with our life and some of the habit patterns that don't help that engagement. I think that's really crucial. They don't help that meaningful engagement. They actually hinder it. You know, it's almost like that the kind of paradox of how you be a self in the world, which you need to be, and hold alongside it a very deep, actually deeply rooted understanding of non-self. And how you keep those two together. I think it's time to end. Thank you. Thank you for coming. Thank you for coming. I hope you're well. Travel well.